Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with Louisa Thomas, whose new book, Conscience, tells the story of her remarkable ancestors.
Once upon a time, he was called by some people America's conscience. A few other people thought he was two steps from Stalin. When I was growing up, he was really just Big Dad, which is what everybody in my family called him.
Julie Bosman is here with Notes from the Field. Katie Royfe on the new phenomenon of semi-happy marriages.
These are people who are pretty unhappy, but not unhappy enough to get divorced. So they're living in a state of dull, quiet desperation.
And Jennifer Schussler has bestseller news. Readers of the Book Review will be very familiar with the byline Louisa Thomas. She is now an author. She's written a book. It's called Conscience, Two Soldiers, Two Pacifists, One Family, A Test of Will and Faith in World War I. It's reviewed for us by Alan Riding, who calls it an enthralling book. I'm delighted that Louise is here to talk about it. Welcome.
I'm delighted to be here.
We'll be very honest about this. Your family is actually a very distinguished American family. You are descended from the celebrated Norman Thomas, although some of our listeners may need to be reminded who he was.
All of my friends will need to be told who he was because he is not very well known anymore. But once upon a time, he was called by some people America's conscience. A few other people thought he was two steps from Stalin. So growing up, I was aware of that tension in the popular imagination. I was also aware that none of my friends knew who he was. And I was kind of curious about why that was.
So he was famous American socialist, famous American pacifist and dissenter. Kind of walk us through the highlights of Norman Thomas's history. And then let's get to this particular crisis of World War I and pacifism.
Sure. He was born in Ohio to a Presbyterian minister, very Victorian. He grew up in a Sabbatarian household. Went to Princeton, partly on scholarship, partly with help from a rich family member, where he performed very well, valedictorian, embraced this movement called the social gospel, which was part of the Age of Reform, and moved into the tenements, became a Presbyterian minister himself. During the war, became a pacifist, eventually a socialist. And after Debs died in 1926...
That's Eugene Debs, the great socialist leader.
The great socialist leader. He became the figurehead of the party and the constant candidate for president. He ran six times on the socialist ticket. In 1932, he did almost decently, and every election thereafter sort of fell off. But he, even as he performed worse at the polls, he sort of occupied a bigger and bigger stage as he spoke out on civil liberties issues, civil rights, and issues about intervening in war. And to a lot of people, including a lot of people who disagreed with him, he was something of a significant figure in American politics and in the American cultural and political landscape.
So when you go out to research a book like this, he's your great-grandfather. You didn't know him. Where do you start?
When I was growing up, he was really just Big Dad, which is what everybody in my family called him. He wasn't really a hero in my household. He was just, you know, like any one of my ancestors. I knew who he was, but it wasn't until after college that I started reading a little bit more about him and became more curious about who he was. And it wasn't until I started reading about his brother, who was a conscientious objector during the First World War, that I really became interested in how he became who he was. Because there's this idea that he went into the tenements and he saw some pretty gnarly stuff, and so hence he became a socialist. I didn't know too many socialists, so that seemed to me to be kind of a funny thing. So I started with the biographies. There are public papers at the New York Public Library. There turn out to be papers all over the country. There are papers in my attic. I have family members who knew him well. I just started asking around.
So you're doing what a lot of people do these days, which is to research their genealogy and ancestry, only you happen to have this very consequential figure in your background. What were the issues in World War I? Probably some people don't remember just what the national mood was at the time when Woodrow Wilson, after having promised to keep America out of war, decided we would enter. What happened to the country then?
Well, the country sort of did a complete flip. World War One turned from something that was pretty unpopular in late 1916 to something that was seen as a kind of crusade by the middle of 1917. The Wilson administration did just an unparalleled job of convincing the country that this was really a big thing. This was something that they had to get behind. That it wasn't just a war over maritime law, you know, unrestricted submarine warfare, but that this was really a chance to help spread American values, American principles, which they called universal, across Europe and eventually across the world.
So Wilson decides this is the great crusade. We have to make the world safe for democracy and export our values. All of this will sound very familiar to our listeners. They'll remember when the president before this one was called a Wilsonian, acting on these same principles. How old was Norman Thomas at this point, and how old was his brother when they dissented?
Norman Thomas was in his early 30s. Evan was in his late 20s. One of the big debates was over the draft. The United States had not had a draft since the Civil War. And even during the Civil War, I think only 8% of the Union soldiers were drafted. You could buy exemptions. And even then, there were huge riots. So this was
right here in New York.
Right here in New York. So it was a big question. How was the draft going to be pulled off? And they introduced this idea that it was service. You know, that it was really volunteering. Norman and Evan didn't see it that way. They thought that conscription was antithetical to freedom of conscience and really antithetical to what it meant to be a free person. Also, that the national mood, along with this kind of very big patriotic spirit, there was a lot of hysteria over the possibility of traitors and communists and Reds. And there was a lot of vigilante justice going on and a lot of persecution of people who were considered radical. And that's what really brought Norman into radical politics.
I mean, really, for the first time since I think John Adams had been president, we actually had an administration that said you could be sent to jail.
Absolutely.
For questioning the war effort, right?
And hundreds were. You know, it was there was a bill that was passed, it was Espionage Act, and it made it illegal to really hinder the war effort. And, of course, there was immense interpretive latitude over what this meant.
You mean what kind of action could be construed
right.
as being disloyal, like maybe even writing an article for a magazine or something like
that? Well, writing an article for a magazine could get your magazine excluded from the mails. The Postmaster General, this Albert Burleson was his name, was an immensely powerful person. I mean, not just because of that, but because, you know, before World War One, the most contact that most people had with the federal government was really the post office. And Burleson had this tremendous power to control the dissemination of information, and he used it. And Norman Thomas was actually the editor of this magazine called The World Tomorrow that was constantly withdrawn from the mails or, you know, they exercised censorship powers.
Now, what about his brother, Evan? How did he register his protest against the war?
If Norman was a radical, then Evan was really radical. Evan hated hypocrisy. He hated what he saw as the sort of squeamish reform efforts of a lot of liberal Protestants. He went to Union Theological Seminary here in New York, which was kind of the bastion of the social gospel movement. But when the war broke out in Europe, he moved to Scotland because he wanted to see a nation at war, and he then moved to London. He was first at seminary, and then he was working with prisoners of war, and he got involved with some of the conscious objector movements over there. You know, he had this idea that he needed to be true to himself and to follow his conscience. And of course, those are indefinable ideas. And the language he used was often borrowed from a lot of social gospel texts and things like that. But he was trying to really interpret them for himself and in new ways, and it led to a lot of, you know, long and painful and lonely hours of struggle, but eventually convinced him that he really needed to come back to the United States, register as a conscious objector, and then take what fate would give him.
And what did fate give him?
He was sent to training camp, actually the same training camp that his brother had just left for France.
Not Norman.
Not Norman.
Another brother.
Sorry, another brother, Ralph, who was a captain in the army.
Now, Louisa, you said that in this period, really the postal service was the connection most Americans had with the government at large. Was it also the way these three brothers communicated with one another? How do we know what each of them thought about the other and how these debates were worked out? Are there letters?
They wrote a lot of letters. Like most people in their era, they wrote a lot of letters. And they wrote letters to each other. They wrote a lot of letters to their mother. And their mother, who is kind of this keystone in this book, I think, actually, because she tried to make sure that every brother knew what the other one was doing. She would write their initials in the corner of a letter she got and circulate it among them. They would cross out the initials once they'd read it and pass it along.
Where are the various places where you found these letters? You said some are some actually in the attic of the house you grew up
in? Some are actually in the – most of Evan's letters were in the attic of the house I grew up. They were right above me all along. I had no idea. Evan eventually went to prison, and he wrote a lot of letters from prison. He wrote a lot of letters to Norman, you know, and Norman was also writing. They were really struggling. You could see in these letters they were really struggling to understand what they were trying to do, even as they were doing it.
You mean they didn't necessarily know themselves?
They were kids. I mean, they were adults, but, you know, they were still trying to figure out how to live and what to do and why and what they could ask of each other and what they could ask of themselves, what they could ask of the government, what they could reject from the government. You know, they were really making it up as they went along, as I think most of us do. They were just doing it in pretty extreme circumstances. That's something I take from Norman's life, too. The journalist Murray Kempton, when he died, said something that really stuck with me when I read it, which is that it wasn't Norman's place in history that Kempton felt so strongly about. It was that he gave the feeling that there was something glorious about being forever engaged. And I think that that's a feeling that a lot of people don't have anymore.
Thanks a lot, Louisa.
Thank you very much.
That's Louisa Thomas, whose new book, Conscience, is reviewed in this week's book review. Julie Bosman's here with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Sam.
So it's that time of year, publishers are reassessing big season, fall seasons to come. What's going on within the industry these days?
Well, we have a little bit of musical chairs this week. Starling Lawrence, who's the longtime editor-in-chief at Norton, said this week that he's going to step down after being editor-in-chief for almost 20 years and give up his managerial duties so that he can just acquire and edit books. Now, Norton, of course, is the largest independent publisher in the business. It's employee-owned, which is very unusual. And it's known for publishing a mix of serious nonfiction like Michael Lewis and literary fiction like Nicole Krauss.
When a change like this happens, sure, there's plenty of chatter in the publishing industry, but is it more important than that? Does this feel like a moment of stock taking, say, among a certain generation of publishers who are watching their business transform at a very rapid rate?
Absolutely. I talked to Mr. Lawrence this week, and he said that this was kind of a moment for him that he decided, you know, he wasn't particularly knowledgeable about electronic publishing. He doesn't really like ebooks very much. He doesn't read ebooks. He doesn't have a personal connection to them. He's 68 years old, and he said that he really just wanted to focus on the reasons that he got into the book business, which was to bring great books to his company's list. You know, he said that if he were 20 years younger, it would be imperative that he understood and educated himself about the issues that are completely transforming the business. But he just found it not very important to him personally, and he wanted to do something different. So his replacement, John Glusman, who's jumping over from Random House, from their Crown Publishing Group, to take his place, you know, has been in the business a long time, but has obviously decided that he wants to take on those kind of responsibilities and usher the publishing house into the digital age.
Julie, you've touched on something that I think our listeners may not necessarily be aware of, which is that most of us identify books with authors. And you think of a great American author like Philip Roth, who's written some 50 books and has shelves and shelves of them and all their different translations. But in some ways, it's actually book publishers, old-time editors and publishers, for whom the book as physical object has the greatest meaning. Is this a generational thing now? Is this shocking to a Bob Loomis or Starling Lawrence to see that the book as object may actually be disappearing?
I think it is shocking for a lot of people, young or old, but especially for that generation who's been in the business for 30, 40 years. Star Lawrence said that he started at Norton something like 42 years ago, and this was a pretty stable business for most of those years, up until perhaps the last 5 or 10, when people really started talking about ebooks. And when you look at what's happened in the last only year or two, I mean, this is really when ebooks have happened. You know, for a lot of books now, they sell 50% in e during the first week on sale and 50% in print. And the business has changed in a way that a lot of people don't want to spend all their time in meetings. They don't want to deal with the sales and marketing teams on every single decision. And that's just not the way that the business has always been. And now with all of the digital considerations, that's just one more change that a lot of people really don't want any part of.
So in a way, then, this dramatic transformation is really the last straw, from P, as they say, to E. That may be the final thing that's made some publishers and editors decide enough.
I would say so. And, you know, for Star Lawrence, he said, look, I want to get back to basics. I want to do what I like to do and why I got into this business, and that's find great books.
Thanks so much, Julie.
Thanks, Sam.
Next, Katie Royfe on the unusual phenomenon of marriages that aren't really sad, but aren't really happy either. We hear the divorce rate is declining, but does that mean the people who are staying married are really happy about it? There's a new book called Marriage Confidential, The Post-Romantic Age of Workhorse Wives, Royal Children, Undersexed Spouses, and Rebel Couples Who Are Rewriting the Rules. It's by Pamela Hogg, and it's reviewed for us by one of our favorites, journalist and author Katie Royfe, who's here to talk about it. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
What on earth is, I'm quoting here, a semi-happy, low-conflict, or this almost sounds Victorian, melancholy marriage?
Well, this is a book that tries to talk about a new problem that has no name in the grand tradition of Betty Friedan. And she's trying to make the argument that our marriages are, these are people who are pretty unhappy, but not unhappy enough to get divorced. So they're living in a state of dull, quiet desperation.
So how does one, or how is our author Pamela Hogg researched this book? Is this a scientific study or is it anecdotal?
It's anecdotal. She does things like she takes out a fake ad in the New York Review of Books pretending that she's looking for affairs, and she goes on websites of people looking for adulterous affairs. She does do an online survey of some kind, and she interviews 50 people. But the problem with this book, I think, is not really the research, which is a little thin. But I don't think that would matter. I think it's more what she's trying to do with it, which is to create this big kind of drum-rolling political problem out of something which I think is a much more nuanced, though interesting, question, which is the how the culture plays itself out within our most intimate lives.
And does she write about the state of marriage from the perspective of both men and women, or is this, since she's a follower and admirer of Betty Friedan, really about women who are unhappily married?
The focus definitely seems to be on these semi-happy women, and she doesn't seem, frankly, as interested in the semi-happy men trapped in these kind of semi-drab marriages. So she's definitely looking at women, and there is a certain double standard in what she thinks is the source of this unhappiness. She thinks it's terribly unfair when women are forced to take on jobs that they don't really like to support their husbands' more creative careers, though she doesn't seem as concerned with men who support, you know, say, a stay-at-home mother. That doesn't seem to be an issue that is disturbing to her.
So we're talking about a middle-class phenomenon, essentially. These are people who are fairly well off. They have kids who are doing okay. by all outward signs, they're successful families, and she's probing beneath the surface, this kind of thing.
That's exactly it. And I mean, I think what's interesting about this book is the tradition that she's trying to write in, which is, I think, Riesman's lonely crowd tradition, trying to diagnose this malaise, as you say, beneath the sort of happy surface of the American family, you know, the kind of middle class American life. And so that's the tradition. And I think it's a great tradition and a worthy tradition, these kind of grandiose, loopy books that we love in our country. But I think the problem here is that this particular phenomenon seems, you know, as you're sort of maybe hinting in your question, just a tiny bit trivial.
Does she explain or theorize about what a really happy marriage would be like, or what's actually missing from these marriages? It, in a specific way, are there conditions you'd rather not have to take a job you don't like? Well, that's true for most of us. But are there other signs? Is there a sexual aspect or a social aspect?
Well, she talks about several things. She does talk about, you know, the kind of classic things people talk about in marriage, which is the restlessness, the lack of passion. You know, is monogamy a natural state to be in? Are we specifically in our culture too focused on our children? And is this kind of child focus draining some sort of energy from our marriages so they are sort of just for show? And I think there's a core of something interesting here, which is a sort of cultural moment that's not quite explained in this book. But I do think she's getting at some kind of unhappiness that she's sort of dancing around the edge of it and not quite putting it into words.
Katie, is there any possibility that, say, a generation ago, these are marriages that would end in divorce, that maybe there is a general feeling now that it's better, maybe because we're so kid-centered, to stay married in this unblissful state than to go through the real disruption of divorce?
That's definitely true, and the divorce rate is definitely lower, and the Times just did that piece in the Style section about the lower divorce rate. So there's certainly a higher threshold or tolerance that we have now for these kind of unhappy marriages. And, you know, the statistics do bear out that people are choosing to stay, perhaps for the children, perhaps because of the stigma currently attached. You know, in the 70s, there was sort of almost a cachet to getting divorced and fulfilling your dreams and, you know, all the kind of rampant kind of ice storm style destruction, which we do not have anymore. And so I think that we are living in a more conservative time that does put pressure on people to stay in situations that they may be not that happy in.
Does she discuss infidelity at all? That was always one outlet. I know in your review you mentioned the great Rabbit novels by John Updike, and major theme there is extramarital sex. Is that something she deals with
at all? She does address it. She kind of strangely hedges the subject. Is it good? Is it bad? Unable, you know, she's not really taking a huge stand on that question. Although she does, as I say, she goes on the New York Review of Books in this fake name, sort of thinking a lot about having lovers, but not actually having them. And I guess some of what she's talking about is a lot of thinking about adultery and not necessarily actually pursuing it in quite the grand tradition of the Rabbit novels. The reason I brought up the Rabbit novels is just to say sometimes I think this subjects like this can be more fruitfully explored in fiction. And I do think the Rabbit novels kind of brilliantly talk about how the particular unhappiness of our marriages is affected by the cultural moment, you know, in each of the decades that he explores, which I think is less successfully done when you're doing kind of internet online surveys and anecdotes about people's marriages that can be a little dull.
So she doesn't really explore these larger cultural questions or not in a very probing way?
I feel like she does explore them, but it has this kind of thin women's magazine-y feel to it, the way that she explores it. And I think the problem is trying to impose these big political ideas on what are actually kind of very complex, nuanced, intimate questions.
Thanks a lot, Katie.
Thank you.
Jennifer Schuster is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
Tell me what's new on the list this week.
Well, over on the nonfiction list, there's a lot of rearranging of the deck chairs. Laura Hillenbrand jumps back on top with Unbroken, a self-fulfilling title if ever there was one. David McCulloch loses a top spot. He drops to number 3 with The Greater Journey. And interestingly, Gretchen Morgenson of The Times and her co-author Joshua Rosner leap to number 4 with their Wall Street book, Reckless Endangerment. It was number 14 last week. It's been on the list for a few weeks, but clearly the interest in this book is heating up.
Good for Gretchen, who was a podcast guest. Any new titles?
Well, there are two that have kind of crawled up from the extended list. Lost in Shangri-La by Mitchell Zukov climbs up to number 14 on the printed list. It is about 3 World War II sightseers who survive a crash in remote New Guinea. And then The Miracle of Freedom by Chris Stewart and Ted Stewart jumps to number 11. You remember we talked about this last week. This is a book that has been touted by Glenn Beck as the best history book he's read this year, and it lands at number 11. We had been wondering if Beck didn't kind of have the mojo to push books onto the printed list. I guess we were wrong.
It looks like he still does. Now, how is Beck's own book doing?
Very well. It's called The Original Argument. It is about the Constitution. It is still at number one on the paperback list. It is number four on the combined nonfiction list, which means only three nonfiction books in any format are outselling it.
Wow. Now, how about Janet Ivanovich's new novel in the Stephanie Plum series doing?
As usual, she enters at number one. This is the 17th book in her series about the charming, semi-competent New Jersey bounty hunter Stephanie Plum. It's called Smoke and 17, and it is actually the 12th in the Plum series to go straight to the top. The last book in the series, Sizzling 16, also enters the mass market paperback list at number two, but Janet Ivanovich has really got to watch out because there's another New Jersey native who is kind of threatening her plan for total world domination. George R.R. Martin, the science fiction fantasy writer behind Game of Thrones, the basis for the HBO series, is all over the paperback lists. All four installments of his Song of Ice and Fire series are on the mass market list. Three of them are on the trade paperback list, and two of them are on the combined list, including Game of Thrones, the first book in the series. It is number three on the combined fiction list. That means that only two books are outselling it in any format. And the fifth book in the series, sorry, throwing around a lot of numbers here, will be out on July 12th, and I will eat my magician's hat if it does not go straight to number one.
Now, this guy doesn't just have readers. He has fans in the original meaning of the word, which is fanatics.
Yes. I mean, interesting. There was a very interesting story in The New Yorker a couple of months ago about how a lot of his fans are actually kind of angry with him that it takes him so long to write each installment of the book. I think it's been about 6 years since the last one appeared. And, you know, this guy's not Janet Ivanovich, who has got the kind of routine down, get your book out every year the same week in June. It's a marketing machine. You know, this guy is, for whatever reason, really struggling writing the next book. And actually, a lot of his fans have kind of turned into detractors. And there are a bunch of sites that are full of very vituperative posts, kind of people pretty much asking for their money back and, you know, saying that George R.R. Martin is letting them down by not writing his books fast enough. So we'll see how they react when the latest one hits the stores in a couple weeks.
Wow, devoured by the mob that loved him. Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.